You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we began our discussion with retired Marine Corps Major General Arnold Punaro, a veteran of Capitol Hill and author of If Confirmed, An Insider's View of the National Security Process. In part one, we explored the foundations of the confirmation process. This week, we continue our conversation, diving deeper into the practical challenges nominees face, from vetting and financial disclosures to the nuances of preparing for Senate hearings. Alisa and General Punaro also examine the historical significance of positions like Secretary of Defense and what makes these roles so vital to national security. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Alisa.
And these are incredibly consequential nominations, given the times we live in, as they are always. And I thought it was very interesting, your point about dropping the numbers down for judges in terms of how many votes you had to have and how that appeared to be short-term thinking based on pushing through a few folks. And whatever you use, somebody else can use against you, right? So let's talk a little bit more about the process, which is there's got to be who guides the nominees through the process. You talk a little bit about Sherpas. Now I'm picturing a guy in nearly bare feet who runs up Mount Everest ahead of some wealthy guy who's got all the gear and later says, you know, he climbed Mount Everest when the Sherpa was up there a day before him. What is a Sherpa other than those kind of mountain guides?
Very few people that get nominated for senior positions in government have any experience dealing with that process. And so like a shepherd that kind of herds his flock and gets them moving in the right direction and makes sure they're well taken care of, we've come up with this term for experts that help guide a nominee through the Senate part of the confirmation process. And we call that person a Sherpa. And it's just kind of a colloquial name we've given. And again, this is the Senate part of the process, not the executive branch nomination part. They don't need a Sherpa for that. That's totally within the control of the executive branch. But what they will do is, for the level one cabinet people for sure, and you've seen like when they have the Supreme Court nominee, they have a Sherpa, a very senior person, a well-known person. For example, former Senator Kelly Ayotte was a Sherpa for one of the Supreme Court nominees. They take them around for their office calls. They help them understand the process. They look and see, oh my goodness, we've got a problem here. We got to go fix that. So a Sherpa is someone that is very close to the administration, represents the executive branch, but guides the nominee and has great insight and knowledge of the committee of jurisdiction that nominee is going to go before, helps prepare them for the office calls where they're going to go meet with the senators in advance privately, although I've always argued there's nothing off the record in a Senate office call, even if they say it's off the record. If there are problem areas that crop up, figure out how to deal with it. They also basically, you know, want to help make sure they have enough votes to get approved both in the committee and on the Senate floor. The Sherpa will have a number of people helping them in the Senate Armed Services Committee. We started when I was staff director and Senator Nunn was chairman, sending them advanced policy questions, because you only get like 5 to 7 minutes in a confirmation hearing to question a witness, even if you get a second round. There are a lot of areas that you want to know the nominee's position, but doesn't rise to the level of a question in a hearing. So we did advanced policy questions, and these things now are 90 pages long. And so that nominee needs help basically answering these policy questions. Some of them need help with the paperwork. You want to make sure the paperwork is apple pie order and they're people with expert. You've got to schedule all these meetings. So you need a scheduler. You now are in a media world. And so particularly if the nominee has had tweets that are not liked by either Republicans or Democrats on the committee, there have been a number of people in both the Biden and Trump previous administrations that have not gotten confirmed because of their tweets. People, the committee of jurisdiction, whether it's on a Democrat or Republican control, they say, holy smokes, you know, this tweet is so unacceptable. You're disqualified from this position. And they've been bounced because of their tweets, not just because of books they wrote or speeches they gave. So they have a lot of media people involved. There's a whole section of people that help a nominee because the process has gotten so complicated and so fraught. Now, typically for people below the maybe the level ones and level twos, once the government is established on January 20th, In every department and agency, there's an Office of Legislative Affairs. In DOD, it's the Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs. They'll have a Senate lead in that. They'll have a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Senate Affairs. That person is typically the expert on the nominations. And then that person really, with the help of the military, becomes the day-to-day Sherpa. Although they still can bring people in from the outside. But once government is up and running, it's mostly done internal to the departments where the nominee is nominated for a position. But now, each of these people that you've heard about, each of these level ones, every one of them has got a Sherpa assigned, and they're working that already. Some of the nominees have already been up on the Hill. One of the Sherpas was the Vice President-elect, J.D. Vance. He was performing the role of a Sherpa. He was taking the nominees around to meet with the senior leadership to kind of get their take and to get their support. Each of them will have a person assigned to them to kind of perform this function.
Okay, well, that's interesting. We see them, but I don't think we know that that's what they're called colloquially. So that's fascinating. You've talked a little bit about sort of the paperwork that you would normally fill out for a security clearance. We talk a little bit about finances and tax. We now have what's called a dark web, and we now have things like cryptocurrency that are not easily traced or identified in terms of financial activity. And I just don't know if the current process is set up to deal with the digital financial world and the space of the internet, which is bigger than the web, which is the dark side of the internet, where people have gone many times and may have been communicating or doing things. Are we really set up for that? Or if you want to talk a little bit about the kind of information that's currently asked and whether it's really modern enough to deal with what the world actually looks like now in terms of communications and financial transactions.
I would say on the financials, on the public financial disclosure, you know, not on the confidential financial disclosure, which if you're going to be a special government employee and you're serving on a Federal Advisory Committee Act board, you don't have to fill out the public one, but you still have to disclose. And on the public one, you have to disclose anything you own. And so if you have some financial asset, whether it's carried on the dark web or whether it's carried in a deep secret in your basement, if you don't disclose that, there's a criminal penalty. And typically the committees will find that stuff. So you're not protected because it's hidden somewhere. And if you hide assets, and by the way, you know, I've looked at some extremely complicated financial disclosures over the years because the Senate Armed Services Committee requires divestiture of assets that you own that might be a conflict of interest or a perception of a conflict of interest once you get confirmed, particularly in the jobs where you're making decisions about buying multi-billion dollar weapon systems. And so financial assets, I think probably the committees don't have enough people to basically go review everything on the dark web, but they find all these troublesome tweets. They certainly find that. But if you fail to disclose, I'll give you a good example. In the Obama administration, Don Remy was nominated to be the general counsel of the Army. And a very qualified individual. He worked at Fannie Mae when Fannie Mae was having all their troubles, although he wasn't involved in it at all. He didn't put that on his resume that he sent to the Senate Armed Services Committee. When I was reviewing his material, one of our colleagues said, wait a minute, weren't you at Fannie Mae? Yeah. Well, you didn't put it on your resume to the Senate Armed Services Committee. Don says, holy smokes, I better do that. Guess what? The White House counsel's office didn't want him to put it on there. And so he didn't. It went to the Senate Armed Services Committee. They knew he'd worked at Fannie Mae. Senator Menendez from Florida, Republican, spotted it, asked him in a confirmation hearing, why didn't you disclose that? What were you trying to hide? He did not get confirmed. In the Biden administration, he was nominated to be the deputy at VA. He filled out all the forms, admitted he was at Fannie Mae, and got confirmed by the Senate unanimously. So if you withhold appropriate information that's supposed to be on your disclosure forms to the U.S. Senate, and they catch you, you are toast.
Let me add to that. I'm noticing something lately that I'm sure you're seeing too, which is obviously our news has fallen into silos. And what I would like to see is a real robust fourth estate, because often they surface these things, the press does. But number two, I think people have to be more realistic. If you've done something somewhere, a hacker's going to find it and they're going to pass that information to a reporter and you're going to be in trouble. I think it's going to affect your nomination. I think people are losing sight of the fact that no matter where a thing is hidden now, there are just dozens of people looking for it wherever it might hide. I don't know if you agree.
let me say, people are not perfect. People make mistakes. I'm actually chairman of the board of the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia, the number 3 rated public policy school in the country. And I'm actually teaching at the University of Georgia this fall, a course called National Security Decision Making, a course I taught in the graduate school at Georgetown for 10 years. And these young students, we are trying to get them to serve in government. We want them to serve in government. They want to serve in government. So they're in a public policy school and they're very interested in these kind of jobs. And you have to get a security clearance. And I tell them, when you're putting in for your security clearance or you want to go to work at the CIA, and I've got 2 students that have already been accepted by the CIA because they started there as an intern a year ago. If you've done something that you're worried about, you don't have to be perfect to get a security clearance anymore. So I tell them, be honest, be truthful. And the same thing goes for the nomination process. There are a lot of things that you do that maybe you shouldn't have done that aren't going to be a bar to you getting confirmed. But if you darn sure try to hide it and you get caught hiding it, they're basically, the Senate is not going to approve you. And by the way, there's a question that presidential personnel ask all nominees, and they say, have you done anything in your life or in your family's life that would be embarrassing to the president if it comes out? They ask them that specific question. If you answer truthfully, let's say you have something, they'll say, well, you know what? We're not going to worry about that. That's not so bad. Or, well, we can deal with that. But if you don't tell them and then it comes out, what I call creeping candor, and you get caught, they're going to pull your nom. And I've seen it happen many times to many people that were highly qualified because they were scared of telling the truth. The Senate, you're right. The information is going to come out. Like we say, bad news doesn't get better with age. Get it out front. And if it's disqualifying, so be it. Most of the stuff is not disqualifying. Most of the disqualifications come when you get engaged in creeping candor, or when the first comes out, you say, well, here's what happened. And then a week later, well, it didn't really happen that way. Here's how it happened. And look,
right,
in the military, we know when there's a conflict or a shoot up or something, first reports are always wrong. I never, ever base my decisions based on what they say within 2 hours of when the incident occurred, because we know it's never accurate. And so you've got to be accurate in this process.
Okay, that's fascinating. And it is true that I think a lot of people are embarrassed by things that don't necessarily have an impact on that. But if you're saying that the question is whether it would embarrass the president, I mean, to be frank, doesn't that a little bit depend on who the president is? So I wonder how that gets processed by a lot of folks.
I think Alyssa's evaluation would be not the president's standard, but something that would be embarrassing to the administration. And so I would say the same standard exists for any president.
Well, that's a very good and diplomatic answer. Impressive. Let's talk a little bit about sort of how they prepare. Let me get off background for a minute, because I think we've talked enough about that. But what do they do to prepare? I mean, you see these people and they get interviewed maybe by the press and they don't seem to have a lot of answers. And then 6 weeks later, they're sitting down for a confirmation hearing and they're on their game. What's going on? How are they getting prepared?
So most of the time, people just coming out of civilian life that aren't career government people, aren't currently in the government, are not going to be up to speed on all the issues they've got to deal with for the position they've been nominated to, particularly if it's one of these level one cabinet positions. So basically, you want that nominee to be as knowledgeable as they can be on the issues that are relevant to that department and are current. I call them hot topics. Other people call them top issues. For the defense nominees, we're typically looking at the 10 big issues, and then maybe up to 40 more hot topics. And you want that nominee to be relatively well-informed. Now, first of all, the nominees don't have access to any classified information. So when a national security nominee comes before the Senate Armed Services Committee, they're not going to be able to talk about anything where they don't have the access to the classified information. And you wouldn't want them to have that. You can't learn enough, you know, in the space of when the person gets nominated to when their confirmation hearing. So you don't want that. And so 2, there are going to be issues where they don't have sufficient knowledge on that topic and they shouldn't pretend they have sufficient knowledge. And we have the nominee say something like, well, Senator, I'm not read in on that. I'm not well informed enough to give you the thoughtful answer you deserve. But if you confirm me, if confirmed, and that's why I titled the book, If Confirmed, you don't want to presume the outcome. The Senate Armed Services Committee hates nominees that think it's automatic and they're going to get confirmed. That's why we tell them all to say, if confirmed, this is what I might do. And so they're not going to be well informed on every subject, but they're going to be well informed on the ones that the administration, and by the way, civilian nominees have no personal views. You represent the administration. You are not entitled to personal views. Military officers are asked by the Senate Armed Services Committee, will you give your personal views even if they differ from the administration in power? If they answer no, they're not going to confirm them. And so military are supposed to give their best military advice. Civilians don't have personal views. You only represent the administration position. Sometimes the administration doesn't have a position on something when somebody's going through the confirmation process. So they get spun up and do their homework, and they visit with the senators and find out what's on the senator's mind. They have to answer the advanced policy question. The senators can tell if the bureaucracy answers the question. And if they do, they send it back and say, we know these aren't your answers. So we tell nominees, make sure you read them and make sure you agree with what the staff may have put together for you. And so they do a lot of preparation. It's not just because you want them to get confirmed. They're going to go into very senior positions in these departments, and you want the people that are going to work for them, and you want the American public to have confidence in the person that's going to be running that agency. So it's important for them to do a good job during their confirmation hearing.
Yeah, you want the American public to have confidence in them. And sometimes, you know, it's also got to be some of our foreign partners have to believe that this Correct. Is a person they can work with. And I think sometimes that's forgotten by people that we still can't go it alone entirely. It's Right. just not ever worked for us. But let's go on. You talked a little bit about a financial conflict of interest. I just want to pause on this because President Trump right now is getting a lot of assistance and he's listening a lot to Elon Musk. Mr. Musk is a tremendously accomplished individual. He owns a number of companies or a CEO and founder of them. And I just have to wonder, because so many of those companies have contracts with the Defense Department. He's not the nominee, obviously, for Secretary of Defense. Where is sort of this line, this issue of financial conflict of interest, where does that fall? If you have a financial conflict of interest, but it's not in the department you're going to head, do you still have to divest? How does that work?
Well, my understanding is right now, my belief is, and I don't have any inside information and I'm not in the loop, but he's a private citizen. He's entitled to any opinion he wants to have. He doesn't have a conflict because he's not a government employee. He's not nominated to a government position. He's a private citizen and he can say whatever he wants to say. Now, if they create this Department of Government Efficiency and he co-chairs it, there's a category that we usually use for a Federal Advisory Committee Act board, which probably this will have to be, because legally you can't set up something like that unless you do it in accordance with the FACA laws. He probably will have to become what we call a special government employee. To be a special government employee, you have to fill out a lot of the forms. That way, the government ethics people will look at it and say, okay, here's his business interest, here's his stock interest and things like that. Here are the things that he shouldn't really be involved in. And so should he elect to basically co-chair a FACA-type board, then he probably will have to go through some kind of process to look at that. Don't get me wrong. We have had people that have exceedingly complex financial situations get through the confirmation process and go into positions in the Department of Defense, and they get recused, as you know, from 2 years from being involved in anything that relates to anything that they might have a financial interest in. We used to require people that had defined benefit plans. No company can afford them anymore, so we don't have that problem. But I remember when Gordon England was going to be the Secretary of the Navy and the Deputy Secretary of Defense, he had worked for General Dynamics, and he had a defined benefit plan that really depended on the performance of that company. And so we made him get an insurance policy so that he would not be wanting to decide things that made sure that his pension was whole. And so there are a lot of ways to basically take care of these conflicts. My instinct would be that should they elect to basically create a FACA board and should they ask Mr. Musk to co-chair it, as they've said publicly, there's going to have to be a process for ensuring there's no crossing of the line on the conflicts or the perception of conflicts. But today he's a private citizen. He's a very prolific tweeter, and he certainly has a lot of opinions, some of which I agree with and some of which I don't.
Yeah, he's definitely a colorful character, tremendously accomplished. But yeah, he does say some things sometimes that are startling. Let's talk about things that can delay a confirmation. And there are going to be a number of those, I imagine, and they're coming from different places.
Well, the vetting process can seriously delay a confirmation. I remember in the Clinton administration, there was a nominee to be a service secretary that had been in the banking business when we were having all the banking problems. and there were a couple of open issues, and the administration and the Department of Defense was pushing the Senate Armed Services Committee, again, Democratic president, Democratic chairman, pushing us to basically get this person confirmed. I said, look, and Senator Nunn concurred with this, as did Senator Warner, the Republican ranking member. We need to sort this out, because if we don't sort it out, he's probably going to be delayed 5 to 6 months when this comes to the committee. You'd be better fixing this in about a month than it's going to take to fix it, rather than pushing out. And by the way, we're not going to run it through anyway. So you're better off fixing any problems in the executive branch in the process before the Senate actually starts considering the nominee. Once you get in the Senate, there could be something that comes out in the FBI full fill, or there can be something in your disclosures. There can be a senator that puts a hold on you. Senators will put a hold on something in committee for something unrelated to the nominee or something related to the nominee. And then, of course, you get out on the executive calendar in the Biden administration. The Deputy Secretary for Acquisition and Support, the Assistant Secretary for Industrial Base Policy, were held up for over a year because a senator on the Republican side had a problem with EPA that they thought if he pressured the defense nominees, defense would call EPA and get them to knuckle under. They don't know much about EPA if they think we're going to, in Department of Defense, get them to knuckle under. They never knuckled under. Finally, he gave up his hold. So nominees, unfortunately, get delayed for nothing related to the nominee's qualifications on a routine basis. Again, we had an Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower and Reserve Affairs that was delayed on the Senate calendar for a year and a half, unrelated to the individual's qualifications. So who would put themselves through that? I hope that the new minority will be for people that are qualified, for people that ought to get confirmed. And if people have a problem, I don't mind holes when there's a question about an individual's qualifications. But hopefully we won't slow roll people just for the business of slow rolling them.
The thing that you know best, though, is the process for Secretary of Defense. It's the big job, right? Give us a little background or history on the Secretary of Defense role. It hasn't existed forever, has it, for example?
So basically, up until World War II, we had a War Department and a Navy Department. So we had the Army and the Army Air Corps. There was no Air Force under one leader. And we had the Navy Department, which was the Navy and the Marine Corps, under another leader. At the end of World War II, we decided to consolidate into the Department of Defense. That was also when we created the National Security Council, the Central Intelligence Agency, and we decided that we needed a civilian Secretary of Defense to control this new entity. And we created the Air Force, which was the only Army Air Corps. So we basically only had a Secretary of Defense of the consolidated national security establishment since the end of World War II. Of course, that person presides over the largest, most complex organization in the world, one that spends more money. The Department of Defense uses more fuel on a daily basis, on a yearly basis, than anybody on earth. I mean, the vast scope of the department. My friend, Dr. Charlie Stevenson, that served with us in the Senate and then was on the faculty at the National War College, has written a book. And the title of the book is The Nearly Impossible Job of Secretary of Defense. That really describes the complexity and the importance. Everything, and when we wrote Goldwater Nichols in 1986, I was the staff director. Senators Nunn and Goldwater led the fight to make sure that we had accountability and a chain of command. We made everything in the Department of Defense subject to the authority, direction, and control of the Secretary of Defense. So it's very, very clear what that individual's statutory authorities are in the department. And again, this is the largest, most complex. We have 1.2 million active duty military, 800,000 Guard and Reserve, 750,000 defense civilians. We have millions of retirees. We have millions of dependents that depend on the Department of Defense, hundreds of thousands of contractors that work for the department every day, either in the department or building the weapons systems, nuclear weapons that are subject to, you know, the nuclear weapons control that the Secretary of Defense is involved in, that could obliterate the entire world and turn the entire world into a dust bowl in the fraction of a second. That's the kind of power that that individual is involved in. And you have skirmishes and actual wars going on at all times, and could go on at all times. Iran has enough enriched uranium to build 5 nuclear weapons. They would like to destroy Israel and the United States. North Korea continues to build their nuclear arsenal. Obviously, we've got China rattling their sailor in Taiwan. We've got Russia in a first war on the continent of Europe since the end of World War II. That's a real war. People are dying and fighting every day. So the Secretary of Defense is, in my judgment, next to the president, probably the most important person in our government.
That's a terrific answer. You know, one of the things I thought was kind of fun in your book was that you even suggest ways to answer questions for these folks during the hearing process.
Right.
And what I noticed is you didn't stick a lot of here's how to kill time, you know, say thank you very, you could do a lot of thanking in your answers and really kill a lot of time. But I did find the book was really comprehensive, and we will include a link in the notes to where you can get that book if you're interested. But I want to thank you very much, sir. I cannot tell you, this has been a delightful conversation. Your knowledge is really just amazing in scope. I will hope to watch these hearings live. I think the American public should be able to see these and understand what's occurring. And I hope that there's as much sort of openness about this process as possible. You have any closing thoughts for us on how we might change this process to increase its efficacy? Because I know you have some real serious thoughts there.
Well, I would say there are three basic reforms in the executive. I would have the executive branch and the legislative branch use the same forms. I would make them all electronic. They're all paper now. I would significantly reduce the number of people that have to go through the confirmation process for DOD. When we first created assistant secretaries, we didn't have undersecretaries. So now they have a supervision layer, so they wouldn't have to go through. And we don't need to do 50,000 military nominations a year. We could just do the admirals and generals. And we could reduce that. We ought to have a time element for the people in the Senate, in the committee, and a time element on the floor if there's no problem with the individual's qualifications. So there are a lot of reforms that could be done to make it work a lot better and to encourage the best people. I would also say in the Senate Armed Services Committee and the National Security Establishment, and me personally, we have benefited from the incredible legal talent that we have had for many of our legal lawyers. The lawyers that work in the Department of Defense, the lawyers that work in national security, the lawyers that I had on the Senate Armed Services Committee that work for Chairman Nunn and Senator Warner, and they've gone on to be the general counsels of DOD. They've gone on to be the chief judge of the Court of Military Appeals. They've gone on to be the chief counsels at CIA. The talent that we have in the government legal profession, at least in the Department of Defense, is really awesome. And we want to thank you and thank our listeners for the people that in the legal community that work these national security issues, both in and out of government. We could not make it, and we would not be as successful as we are today without them.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to say to a group of lawyers. And I know they love being told that because they do work hard. The pay is not as good in firms. Let me just give our listeners a couple of pieces of news to the point about how important it is to have a highly qualified Secretary of Defense. It is now the case that Yemenis and foreign nationals, including mercenaries, have joined the Russians on the front in Ukraine. That is a disturbing development. We knew the North Koreans were funneling in. We've also been told that South Korea is very cleverly using some cognitive warfare and suggesting to some of them that they run away when they get there, which I think we can only hope some of them do. The second thing that I think poses a significant national security risk where I think the Department of Defense is ultimately going to have some equities is that Huawei is now coming out with a phone that is running on its own operating system. Now, why does that matter? It's going to be cheaper than Apple. It's going to be everywhere. And as you know, there have been some serious concerns with Chinese technology and the supply chain. These are very serious things, and they're subtle. They look small, but they're massive. And all of these things are going to have to be managed in addition to, you know, multiple hot wars and all sorts of threats by anyone who is in charge, as well as just these millions of individuals and programs and doctors and everything that they're going to have to oversee in the Department of Defense. I think it's the world's largest employer, isn't that right? Outside of maybe the department in China. It's hard to even think of who would be the best person. But what a pleasure to talk to you, sir. You really are a knowledgeable human being, and it's been a delight. And I think anyone to work with you and get your knowledge who faces this process would be quite fortunate.
Thank you. Such a privilege to be with you.
Our guest tonight has been Arnold Punaro. He has written a book that is very, very interesting, and I would commend to you if you're interested in this process. It's called If Confirmed, An Insider's View of the National Security Process, referring to nominations. We'll include a link to Mr. Punaro's incredible bio, as well as I've mentioned, the link to vendors. And it is really quite a read if you're interested in this area of work. So thank you to our listeners for tuning in tonight. We really appreciate you. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to share this episode with a friend. Remember to discuss any of the topics that we've covered in a thoughtful way, hearing other people's facts, opinions, and arguments. It'll improve your skills as a lawyer. Remember, a key feature of our national security is a unity in a country that's more diverse in many ways, not just ethnicity, but thought, than any other country. Our writer and producer and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the ever lovely, hardworking, and just amazing Holly McMahon, who is still standing after the conference and the biannual meeting. But really importantly, I want to thank all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would be impossible. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.